This is Side B of the cassette tape lecture for the month of June 1991. The title of this second lecture is Declaring War on Idolatry. It is interesting that the last thing the Apostle John said in his first epistle was this command. He said, "Little children, keep yourself from idols," unquote. 1 John chapter 5 and verse 21. Now the Apostle must have thought it was important if we do that very thing. We should keep ourselves from idols, that is, from idolatry. But what is idolatry? One has to know what constitutes an idol, or let's say idolatry itself, to be able to keep ourselves from doing anything of this nature. We have to know what idolatry is, as far as God is concerned. And may I ask this question, just what is idolatry? Well, let me put it this way. It is anything that God considers as idolatry. It's not what God, a man might think. It's not what angels might think. It's not what anybody might think. Only what God thinks is idolatry, happens to be idolatry. Now, some of us may feel that certain things aren't. We may like them. We may want to keep them. We may feel that it doesn't make any difference whether we worship through them or use them or admire them or whatever. But you know, our opinion is not that which counts in the point of view of God. If you want to know what idolatry is, you have to have Him Himself, God, define it. And He does it through His Word, the Holy Bible. And He makes it pretty clear what idolatry is. Strangely, however, in the Bible you may find, in fact you can find, quite a number of items that at first God considered perfectly all right to use. But because people began to misuse them in their worship of Him, He came to the place of utterly condemning them and said they cannot be used anymore. One such thing was the use of His name. It was quite common in the earlier period of the time of Abraham and Moses and on down to the time of David and Solomon for people to call God by the name Baal. It simply meant my owner or my master. But because the word Baal got attached to the heathen gods, more or less as a common name, a proper name, and he began to get confused with the other gods, that is, in the minds of the people, he utterly forbade that that name be used of him in a proper sense from then on. You can read it right there in the book of Jeremiah. So you see, what was perfectly all right at one time, because of a tinge of evil, or a darkness of evil that came over the name, that gave a wrong impression to people, God Himself can change His mind. And He will say, and He has said, don't do this anymore, even though it was allowed at one time. We find all types of examples like this in the Scripture. In fact, idolatry itself is what God Himself considers to be idolatry. And in many instances, lots of people would say that it's not. And in fact, you can go back to the earlier period of, let's say, the father of the faithful, none other than Abraham himself. Certain things that he did, he would not have considered as being idolatrous at all. And God didn't even condemn him for some of the things that he did. But later on, because people began to use the very things that Abraham was doing, and transferring them into wrong usages, God began to call them idolatrous, and He forbade that they be used anymore. Abraham would be very surprised to find out what God considered as idolatrous in the time of Moses from what he himself, 400 years before, was accepting as the truth, because he didn't find God condemning him in certain things that later on Moses saw was wrong. They were wrong, as a matter of fact, and we have later teaching in the time of Jacob that shows how some of these things became wrong, and God then changed His mind and said, from now on, they're going to be considered idolatrous, and no one is going to keep them if you're going to obey Me. So you see, it's who is in charge of this whole thing. Who is it that gives the dictionary definition of what idolatry is? Well, it's God Himself, and He can change His mind if He wants to. Certain things that were righteous, and you know, this is the most interesting thing, righteous, good, holy, proper, and everything of that nature, began to be, later times, evil because of the wrong association. You know, as far as images and idolatry is concerned, I mean as making sticks, carving out sticks of stone, sticks and stone, that is, images and things from there. Do you know, in the whole of the Old Testament period, I mean in the pre-flood period, do you know there's no condemnation of that whatsoever? And not even in the time of Abraham was there. But you take the time of Moses, and all of a sudden, he just comes right out as strong as he can right in the Ten Commandments itself and says, you are not to make anything of any image in heaven above, on earth here, or in the waters beneath. That means fishes or anything of that nature. And he became very strong. But in the earlier period, that wasn't the case. And Abraham did things that would cause the eyebrows to go up on some people's faces, simply because what Abraham was doing back at his time was not considered idolatrous by God. But later on, when people began to misuse these things and to abuse them, then God began to change his mind, and he put restrictions upon the use of certain things. And that is absolutely a fact. For example, in Genesis 21, verse 33, we find that Abraham, it says, planted a grove. What it actually means in the Hebrew, he planted an Asherah, which was a type of a tree which was to be used for religious purposes. He did it in Beersheba. You can read it here in verse 33. And Abraham planted a grove or a tree in Beersheba and called there on the name of the Lord, the Aeonian of God, the God of the ages. And you know, it was a tree, all right. But later on, this very word which is used here for this tree, the type that Abraham planted, became idolatrous, and it was known as an idolatrous implement by the time of Solomon and on down, that anyone who did such a thing as that was utterly condemned by God, and it was not allowed. Now, as I said before, by the time of Moses, such things were considered as idolatrous. But Abraham didn't think that way at all. And in fact, what you really have to look at is some other examples that we find in the scripture where God didn't condemn the people at all. Let us go down to a third generation from the time of Abraham. Here was Jacob. Now, Jacob wasn't all that righteous right at first, but he had some lessons he had to learn. But he made a journey up north to get a wife. And he finally got two of them and two concubines, and he headed on south back to Palestine. And on the way south, a little story develops here concerning his wife Rachel. Now, this is Rachel who did this. That is true. However, Jacob was allowing it to be done, and we don't have any condemnation given in the Bible of what was actually happening in regard to these items that Rachel, wife of Jacob, was actually doing. And let's read this here a little bit because it's rather interesting. People have wondered over this in the past. And here it is in the book of Genesis, beginning in chapter 31 and verse 17. Then Jacob rose up and set his sons and his wives upon camels. Now, he was up in Mesopotamia at this time, in the northern part of it, and he was heading south into the land of Canaan. We call it Palestine today. And he carried away all his cattle and all his goods, which he had gotten, the cattle of his getting, which he had gotten in Padan Aram. Now, that's Mesopotamia. And he wanted to go to Isaac, his father, in the land of Canaan. And Laban, now that was the father of Rachel, went to share his sheep. And Rachel had stolen the images, it says here, that were her father's. Now, Laban was living in Mesopotamia. And up there, they were not keeping the laws that we have in the scripture as best as possible. We know that much. But we still find that here was Jacob up there to get a wife. And he came back with two wives and two concubines. That's true, but what he did was to learn the customs up there of everything, and God didn't seem to mind that all that much. So here was Laban looking for his teraphim, looking for his images, and he was very interested in these images, and because they were Laban's. But who stole them? Rachel. Now, why in the world would she steal these teraphim, these images? Well, you know, we have found in archaeology, through archaeology, some of these teraphim and images of the various gods and things like this. Now, this was way back in the time before Moses, before idolatry was utterly condemned, before image-making was condemned. But here were these images, and Rachel had taken them, and she'd put them in her baggage. Jacob didn't know about them. He was unaware of them. But Laban, all of a sudden, missed them, and he was very worried. And he wanted to go after Jacob because he felt that Jacob himself had stolen them. And they were very, very important to him. Now, you might say from a religious point of view, yes, but from another point of view as well. As I said before, through archaeology, we have found several of these going back to the time of Jacob here and a little earlier. And you know what we find on the bottom of them? They were made like little gods, little statues and things like that. But here was at the bottom of them, written in the ancient language, territorial descriptions of lands that were owned by the person who had the teraphim, who had the images. They were title deeds. And they were supposed to be title deeds that were guaranteed by these gods and these goddesses. And whoever controlled or had in his or her hands these teraphim, these images, had the will, or shall we say, the territorial demands, the legal deed, shall we say, to the territories that was described therein. Now, here was Laban allowing Jacob to go on south with the two daughters, that's quite true, and with the two concubines. But you know, he could then see that with these images, which on the bottom of them had territorial deeds inscribed, well, he could take over the whole land back up there that he was controlling himself. And so he got very busy and started on south after Jacob and the rest of them. Now, Jacob stole away the unawares to Laban, the Syrian, in that he told him not that he had fled. Well, he hadn't fled yet, but anyway, he found out that he was on the way, and he went after him. God came to Laban, the Syrian, in a dream by night, and said to him, "Take heed that you speak not to Jacob either good or evil." But Laban went on south. Laban overtook Jacob. Now Jacob had pitched his tent in the mount, and Laban with his brethren pitched in Mount Gilead. And Laban said to Jacob, "What have you done that you have stolen away unawares of me and carried away my daughters as captive, taken with the sword? Wherefore did you flee away secretly and steal away from me?" Now he did not know that he had stolen the images as well. And it goes on to say, verse 30, "And now, though you would need be gone, because you sore longest after your father's house, yet wherefore have you stolen my Elohim, my gods? You have taken them as well." And Jacob answered and said to Laban, "Because I was afraid, for I said, peradventure you wouldest take it by force thy daughters from me. With whomsoever you findest thy gods, let him not live before our brethren. Discern thou which is thine with me, and take it to thee." He says, "Listen, I didn't steal your gods. I didn't steal your Elohim. I didn't have these teraphim, and I don't have them." He said, "Go ahead. Whoever has them," said, "let it be, let him be killed." So Jacob knew not that Rachel had stolen them. He didn't know that. Laban went unto Jacob's tent, and into Leah's tent, and into the two maidservants' tents, but he found them not. Then went he out of Leah's tent and entered into Rachel's tent. Now Rachel had taken the images, that is the Elohim, the gods, and put them in the camel's furniture and sat upon them. And Laban searched all the tent, but found them not. And she said to her father, "Let it not displease my lord that I cannot rise up before you, for the custom of women is upon me." And he searched, but found not the images. In other words, she was menstruating, to be quite blunt about it. And if he would have touched her, even according to the laws of the Chaldeans back at that time, he would have been, no doubt, unclean for some time. And so he didn't touch her. And she maintained the images. Jacob was wroth and chode with Laban, because he said, "See, I told you I didn't take the gods. I didn't take the teraphim. I didn't take your title deeds. I didn't take them at all. I'm just going back to Canaan, to my father. Where is my trespass?" he says. "What is my sin that you have hotly pursued after me?" Now it goes on that Laban finally cooled down as far as his temper was concerned when he and Jacob decided to do one thing. So Laban said this, "All right, I'll tell you what." Now I'm paraphrasing. "Let us make a heap of stones. Let us build a cairn of stones. And at this cairn of stones, probably in a pyramidal type of shape or something like that, we're not absolutely told what it was, but this is in verse 48. Laban said, "Let us make a heap of stone, and let this heap be a witness between you and me this day." Therefore was the name called Gilead. And you know, to the in the time of Christ, they were still calling that area east of Jordan and over near Mount Hermon, in that region there, calling it Gilead. And Laban said, "This heap, this rock heap, let it be a witness between me and you this day." And he also called it Mizpah, which means like a tower. For he said, "The Lord watch between me and you when we are absent one from another. Now, if you will afflict my daughters, or if they shall take otherwise besides my daughters, No man is with us. See, God is witness between me and you, he says. Just between you and me. And Laban said unto Jacob, Behold this heap, and behold this pillar, which I have cast between me and you. Let it be a heap of witness. And it says this, that you shall not pass over this heap, and I shall not pass over this heap. In other words, this is going to be our territorial boundary from now on. And I won't require the gods. I won't require these teraphim. I won't require all of this. If you will swear before the God of Abraham, verse 53, the God of Nahor, the God of their father, judge betwixt us. And Jacob swear by the fear of his father Isaac. Then Jacob offered sacrifice upon the mount, called his brethren to eat bread. They tarried all night, and early in the morning, Laban was completely satisfied, rose up, kissed his sons and daughters, blessed them, and Laban departed and went on back home. He wasn't caring anymore about those teraphim. Because you see, in a sense, that new heap of stone that had been raised up with inscriptions on it saying, Laban shall not come south of this, and Jacob and his descendants shall not come north of this stone. This will be Laban's land from then on. And you know, really, the land of Lebanon today, which is north, is really named after Laban as a result of this. And the land of Lebanon on the east there, I mean on the in the Middle East, is really a part of this, though the land has changed somewhat as far as the geographical terminology is concerned. But it all goes back to this heap that was raised up. So we find that Laban then found that his teraphim, which were title deeds to land, became invalid once this heap was raised up. And everybody was able to know about it. And here is the God of Abraham, Isaac, Abraham, I should say, and Nahor, actually witnessing this. And so Laban went on back. So the territorial deeds on the teraphim were no longer valid. But that's what Rachel wanted. She was the type of woman who said, well, listen, I'll go down to Canaan if I want to, and I'll stay down there as long as I can. And if I don't like it, I'm coming back up here, and I've got title deeds to my land. And that's what she was trying to do. Well, Laban was completely satisfied when those title deeds were then made invalid. And we find it here. Now, those teraphim were small idols, as we call them today, small images. And at the bottom of the images were these territorial descriptions. And they were nothing more than title deeds, and that's the way they did things in those days. And we don't find any condemnation from God on that. That is, at this juncture. But a little bit later, we do find that God comes to Jacob, whose name was changed to Israel, and then he begins to say something to him differently than what he allowed before. Look at Genesis 35 and verses 1 through 4, and here's what we find. And God said unto Jacob, Arise, go up to Bethel, and dwell there, and make there an altar unto God, and that appeared unto you when you fled from the face of Esau your brother. Then Jacob said unto his household, and to all that were with him, Put away the strange gods that are among you, that is the foreign gods, the Elohim, and be clean, and change your garments. Let us arise, and go up to Bethel, and I will make there an altar unto God, you see, only to the one God. Only to the true Elohim, who answered me in the day of my distress, and was with me in the way which I went. And they gave unto Jacob all the strange Elohim, that means the strange gods, which means the images, which were in their hand, and all their earrings. Earrings, by the way, normally was to show who you were a servant to. An earring in a person's ear was always showing a slave. And you see earrings in people's ears today, it means you're a slave. And so you ought to ask them, who are they slave of? Because that's what it means. And for women to wear earrings, perfectly fine, because they had to submit to their husbands. You see the point? But for a man to wear an earring was not quite looked upon as proper unless you ask him, who are you a slave of? But in this case, they were earrings dealing with theological matters. And Jacob hid them under the oak which was by Shechem. He just buried them real deep, put them under the oak. And the oak, you see, got bigger and bigger, and no one then could dig them up because the oak tree would cover them. He wanted to get rid of the strange gods once he came back to Bethel and where his name was changed to Israel. From the time his name was changed to Israel, then there was to be one God, and they were not to use these other gods anymore. Prior to that time, however, it was perfectly all right to do so. And at least there's no condemnation whatsoever. But all of a sudden now, the strange gods are to be got rid of. Now, when it comes to the time of Moses, which is a few generations later, about four generations or five, then God takes the Israelites out to the land of Sinai, takes Moses up to the Mount Sinai, and gives him Ten Commandments. And when he gives Ten Commandments there, he reiterates what happened to Jacob back here in the time of Bethel, where his name was changed to Israel. They are not to have any other gods, not like the others in the past, but they're not to have any other gods, nor are they to make images, that is, of things in heaven, things on earth, or things under the earth. You know the Ten Commandments there. But what we find is that God then said, a new set of regulations were going to come on the scene, denoting what was idolatry and what was not. Because in earlier times, there was no condemnation. And even in Abraham's time, there was not. But step by step, because of misuse or various things of that nature, then God stepped in and began to classify what was wrong and what was not wrong. In fact, let's just even mention Moses here. Moses was told, and when the children of Israel were in the land of the wilderness, to because snakes had come out and were biting the people and many of them were dying, Moses was instructed by God to do something. Now, I know that you're well aware of this incident here, but let's turn to Numbers chapter 21, because it's a very interesting thing here, how Moses was instructed to do something which you might think was forbidden in the Ten Commandments. And in fact, it was forbidden in the Ten Commandments. But I'm going to tell you something about this in a moment and how that it was perfectly proper for Moses to do this at the time that he did. I think it'll be rather interesting to you. Because you see, it is God who determines what is idolatrous and what is not. That's what I'm trying to show. That is the biblical teaching on the matter. Here is Numbers chapter 21. And when King Arad, the Canaanite, which dwelt in the south, heard tell that Israel came by the way of the spies, then he fought against Israel and took some of them prisoner. And it goes on to say in verse 6, the Lord sent fiery serpents among the people, and they bit the people, and many people of Israel died. Therefore the people came to Moses and said, we have sinned, for we have spoken against the Lord. And verse 8 now, and the Lord said unto Moses, make you a fiery serpent, set it upon a pole, and it shall come to pass that every one that is bitten, when he looks upon it, the pole and the fiery serpent, shall live. Now what does he mean by fiery serpent? It means a serpent that has venom in it. That is a very deadly serpent. So Moses made a serpent of brass, put it on a pole, and it came to pass that if a serpent had bitten any man, which he beheld the serpent of brass, when he beheld the serpent of brass, he lived. And the children of Israel set forth and pitched in Oboth, and they carried on their journey. That serpent, brass serpent on a pole, continued with Israel for a number of centuries after this. And in fact, we find that in the time of King Hezekiah in the 8th century B.C., now this comes down to almost 700 years after Moses had made this serpent and all of that and put it on a pole, and it was all brass, that the people had come to the place of using this, this instrument here, which in the time of Moses they were just using all the time if anyone was bitten by a serpent. But look what happens here in the time of Hezekiah. In 2 Kings chapter 18, it says that Hezekiah, the son of Ahaz, king of Judah, began to reign. That's verse 1. He reigned for 29 years in Jerusalem. He did that which was right in the sight of the Lord, according to all that David his father did. He removed the high places. That means where the heathen gods were. He broke the images. Now, back in the time of Rachel, the images weren't broken. But he broke the images. He cut down the groves, that is the Asherim. Abraham himself planted the Asherah. But here he was breaking them down at this time, because now they were wrong to use and could not be used. He broke in pieces, now notice this, the brazen serpent that Moses had made. For unto those days the children of Israel did burn incense to it. You see, they were using it for a wrong purpose. They weren't using it the way that Moses said to do, or God said, when they got bit by a serpent. Now, by the way, when they got bit by a serpent, what they would do is to go into the tabernacle. This instrument, or this brass instrument, was in the tabernacle. It's most important that it had to be in the tabernacle. I'm going to show you that in a few moments. Because, you see, in the tabernacle, the laws which dealt with imagery did not apply. And I'll show that to you in just a few moments. So when they would get sick or bitten by a serpent, they would go into the tabernacle, they would see this, and they would pray to God, not to the image. But now at this time, they were offering incense to the image. And when Hezekiah, the righteous king, saw this, and he was there at the time of the prophet Isaiah, he then took that brazen serpent that Moses had made. Now, you know, this is 700 years old. This was a relic of great worth. This is made by the great Moses himself, by none other than a command of God. And you know what he did? He just turned it into ash. He ground it to powder, and he called it Nehushtan, which means it's nothing but a piece of brass. That's all. In other words, they were misusing this, and that's the last time that God ever allowed that type of a thing to be used. But you know what we see it today in? Well, you can't go to a medical doctor hardly, or to a hospital, without seeing that caduceus there. And what is it? A pole either with one snake on it or two. Now, the thing is, at the first it was perfectly all right to use. But people were misusing it, and to the extent that the heathen had actually taken it up and they were misusing it, they were having incense to it and everything of that nature. And so Isaiah came to Hezekiah, no doubt, and told Hezekiah what was going on. Hezekiah took that very image made by the great Moses himself, ground it to powder, and said, listen, it's nothing but a piece of brass, and get rid of it. And you know, God changed his mind, didn't he? That's in the Bible for a reason. And anything that even God makes, if it's used for a wrong purpose, God can say it becomes idolatrous. And you know, what you have to see is this, that in the time of Moses, in the Ten Commandments, even though teraphim were used earlier on, and Asherah were used, Abraham, by the time of Moses, after Israel, Jacob's name was changed to Israel, then God said, I don't want you using any of those things anymore, that they are now idolatrous. Let's look at the Ten Commandments, for example, here, given by God himself through the angel of the Lord, here in Exodus chapter 20. But here's what he says in the first commands. Well, first of all, I am the Lord your God, which have brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. Number one, you shall have no other Elohim before me, no other gods but me. That's number one. Now look at number two. You shall not make unto you any graven image, or any likeness of anything that is in heaven above, or that is in the earth beneath, or that is in the water under the earth. Now that's pretty inclusive, isn't it? Anything in heaven, anything on earth, or anything in the waters, like fishes or octopus or whatever underneath the water. You're not to make any images of them. You shall not bow down yourself to them, nor serve them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children unto the third and fourth generation of them that hate me. All right, now, he just gives an absolute command that no graven images from this time forward would be allowed. It would be considered as idolatrous. But you know the interesting thing? Not more than a few moments later, almost, just a few days, we find in chapter 25 over here of the book of Exodus. Now this is after Moses had just come down from the mount. The blood of the covenant had been sprinkled upon the Ten Commandments as well as the other subsidiary laws. And then here is what Moses was commanded to do. It says here, now this is chapter 25, that in verse 17, and you shall make a mercy seat, which means an ark of the covenant, of pure gold. 2 cubits and a half shall be the length thereof, and 1.5 cubits the breadth thereof. And you shall make 2 cherubs of gold, of beaten work shall you make them, in the 2 ends of the mercy seat. And make 1 cherub on the one end, and the other cherub on the other end. Even of the mercy seat shall you make the 2 cherubim on the 2 ends thereof. And the 2 cherubs shall stretch forth their wings on high, covering the mercy seat, with their wings, and their faces shall look one toward another. Toward the mercy seat shall the faces of the cherubs be. And it goes on to say in another section here that they're to be molded together into one image, but 2 of these cherubimic creatures, angelic creatures, are to be facing one another with their symbolic wings stretching out over the mercy seat. The mercy seat was typically designed to be emblematic of the throne of God. This mercy seat with these 2 cherubs welded together in one unit was to be placed in the Holy of Holies in the temple. Now, I thought we had just read a little bit before here in the Ten Commandments that no images were to be made either in heaven, from heaven above, earth beneath, or in the seas underneath. And right here is a command going forth to make these two images. Now that seems like a contradiction, doesn't it? Well, it's not. Because you see, in the tabernacle itself, which was an example, a pattern of the very palace of God in heaven, that was the exception to the rule. They actually had cherubs there in the Holy of Holies in the time of Solomon. In fact, even back in the time of Moses, they had cherubs on some of the curtains, and they were able to show other things in there. In the time of Solomon, and when he constructed the laver outside of the holy area, it was in the court of Israel, but outside of the holy place, he had it situated on the backs of 12 oxen, and that was perfectly allowable there. And as far as this caduceus was concerned, as we call it today, where a brass pole was there and a serpent made out of brass, that was all right as long as it was in the temple. But it could not be anywhere else. And they made high places, though, on every high hill and places of that nature. Those things were not allowed. But the exceptions were those that God accepted. This is what we've got to understand. It was perfectly all right to have images of the cherubim, both on the curtains and in the Holy of Holies. It was perfectly proper to have those bullocks in the temple there, and that was not condemned by God at all. When Solomon put the laver outside of the holy place on the backs of these oxen, and it was perfectly proper for Moses to do what God said, to make the brass serpent. And it was in the tabernacle as well, that when someone was bitten by a serpent, well, they would go in there and they would appeal to God by looking at that, and everything would be fine. You see, God is the one who sets up all of the parameters of what constitutes idolatry and what does not. All right, now what happened to these two cherubs? Well, it says that they covered the mercy seat. And this is most interesting, because when we come down to the 6th century B.C., now this is about 800 years after the time of Moses. Moses actually was instructed to make these two cherubs and to put them in the Holy of Holies, the holiest place in the whole temple. And these two cherubs represented two angelic powers that were in heaven, that were so close to God that one was on the right hand of God and one was on the left side. And they were identical because they faced each other, and they represented these two cherubimic powers in heaven. Well, we come down to the 6th century B.C., though. And this is the time of the great rebellion that Judah performed against God. Israel had already been taken captive in the 7th century B.C., 7th and 8th, and now that's the northern kingdom of Israel. But now the Jews were doing the same thing, and God sent them two major prophets at the time. One of them was Jeremiah, and the other was Ezekiel. Now, what does Ezekiel say about one of these cherubs? He does not identify which one it is, but he says something very interesting. And most of us have been knowledgeable of what Ezekiel back in the 6th century said. And let's quote him, though, beginning in verse 11 of chapter 28. Moreover, the word of the Lord came unto me, saying, Son of man, take up a lamentation upon the king of Tyre, and say unto him, Thus saith the Lord God, you seal up the sum, full of wisdom and perfect in beauty. You have been in Eden, the garden of God. Remember that in Eden he set up the cherubim. Remember to keep the people, Adam and Eve, away from the garden. Well, this particular king of Tyre here, the spiritual power that was in charge of the Tyrian or the Phoenician area, had been back there in the garden of God. Every precious stone was your covering. The sardis, the topaz, the diamond, the beryl, the onyx, the jasper, the sapphire, the emerald, the carbuncle, the gold, and workmanship of thy tablets and of thy pipes was prepared in you in the day that you were created. And you are the anointed cherub that covers. Now that verse 14 tells us something there. Because these two cherubs that were in the Holy of Holies overshadowing the mercy seat, something happened to one of them in the 6th century B.C. And it couldn't have been much before this time. It says, you art the anointed cherub that covers, and I have set you so, says God. You were up on the holy mountain of God, that is in heaven. You have walked up and down in the midst of the stones of fire. You were perfect in your ways from the day that you were created till iniquity was found in you. Now a time came when he became iniquitous, this cherub. By the multitude of your merchandise they have filled the midst of you with violence, and you have sinned. Therefore I will cast you as profane out of the mountain of God. I will destroy you, O covering cherub, from the midst of the stones of fire. Your heart was lifted up because of your beauty. You have corrupted thy wisdom by reason of thy brightness. I will cast you to the ground, that is, to the earth. I will lay you before kings, and they may behold you. You have defiled my sanctuaries. That means the holy place of God, where he was, by the multitude of your iniquities, by the iniquity of thy traffic. Wherefore I will set a fire upon the midst of you, and it shall devour you and bring you down to ashes. Now this is the word of the eternal God. So something happened not long before the time of Ezekiel here that caused God to actually chastise one of those cherubs that was represented back there in the time of Moses. They were perfect, both of them were, in the time they were created. But this one here became iniquitous. The interesting thing about it was, to throw one out of heaven, what would happen to the other, even the righteous one on the other side, because they were welded together, if you'll read the whole thing, in one image, two of them overshadowing the mercy seat. Only one of them was cast out. And this was an anointed cherub. Now, many people identify this with Satan the devil. But you see, it can't be Satan the devil. Satan the devil is more powerful, believe it or not, in one way of looking at it as far as the earth is concerned. Because Satan the devil was a murderer from the very beginning. But this person wasn't. This cherub here was made perfect in the day that he was made. He became iniquitous. And when? Well, we don't read of his iniquity until the time of Ezekiel. And these two cherubs, however, and one of them now cast out, were hovering over the mercy seat, which was looked on as the Ark of the Covenant. And at this same time that Ezekiel is saying this, you know what Jeremiah the prophet was saying, who was his contemporary? In actual fact, he lived shortly before his time, but they were contemporary to one another. Here is Jeremiah speaking about the Ark of the Covenant. And you'll read it in the third chapter of the book of Jeremiah. You ought to read it all together there, but down in verse 16, it says, here is Jeremiah for the first time that says, one of these days I'm going to gather you Israelites back. I'm going to bring you back to the Holy Land here. You're going to be in Palestine. And at that time, the Ark of the Covenant, it'll neither come to mind anymore. Neither will you remember it. Neither shall you visit it. Neither shall it be done anymore. You will not come up to visit the Ark of the Covenant anymore. And in that Ark of the Covenant, or over it, were these two cherubs. It's most interesting. At this time, Jeremiah is showing the Ark of the Covenant is not needed anymore. And we find that Ezekiel says that one of the cherubs had gone astray. Well, what in the world happened as far as the Jews were concerned? Well, they were destroyed. The temple was destroyed. And from that time forward, no one has ever heard of where the Ark of the Covenant is or where the two cherubs are. Now, when Ezra and Nehemiah, with Joshua and Zerubbabel, when they came back from the Babylonian captivity and rebuilt a temple down there in Jerusalem, the Ark of the Covenant was not in it. The two cherubs were not in it. In the time that King Herod, just before the birth of Christ, extended the temple and made it more beautiful and enlarged it and all of that, within the Holy of Holies there in the temple that existed in Christ's time, there was no Ark of the Covenant. There were no cherubs there in that. They were taken out. And you know, when one was expelled, even the good one had to go with him because they're welded together, you see, in the symbolism. Now, what happened to that Ark of the Covenant? Well, in 2 Maccabees, a book written about 100 years before the birth of Christ, in chapter 2, it says that a record was found in the time of Nehemiah, which says that the tent of meeting, that is the tabernacle, and the Ark of the Covenant, and no doubt associated with that, the cherubs and all of that, well, they were taken by Jeremiah the prophet to an area east of the River Jordan near where Moses was buried. And there he buried the tent, the ark, and the incense altar. That is what this record that was found at the time of Nehemiah said. And it's recorded here in 2 Maccabees. And when Jeremiah, who was a priest, took it all over there, he found a cave, took them all in there, buried them, and then apparently an earthquake came or something like that. And when people then that were with him said, we'll mark the way back here, so when we come back we will find it. He said, no. No one is going to find it, it says here, until the future, when God himself will see to it. And then these will be discovered again. Now that's in 2 Maccabees. That's not a part of the scripture. But this was in Jewish teaching at the time that Christ was here on earth. And it says, Jeremiah went on supposedly to say, that when these are found, God will allow them to be seen, and then, like in the time of Solomon, fire will come down out of heaven and then bless this material, and it can be used again, but not until that time. Now, it says fire shall come down out of heaven. Well, you know, at the end of the age, an image is going to be found or made, and you know, it's going to be an image of the beast. And this cherub that's found back here in Ezekiel 28 has been disqualified. It's most interesting. And you know, when you look at the book of Revelation, and it speaks there about two individuals coming on the scene, one called the beast and the other the false prophet. The false prophet is going to bring down what? Fire out of heaven, like in the time of Solomon. And it's going to deceive the world. And they're going to make an image, and they're going to put it in a temple, because that beast is going to sit in the temple, and he's going to have his image in the temple. And you know, the only image that is allowed in the Word of God to be in the holy place is the cherubim. It may well be that these cherubs could be found again. Now, would Jeremiah allow the one on the right or the left, whichever one it is, that was disqualified to be in the temple, be there? In actual fact, we find that in the Scripture itself, Jeremiah says, from now on, when God regathers his people back to the land of Palestine, really, in the third chapter of Jeremiah, you will not need the Ark of the Covenant anymore. You will not even think about it. You will not even come up to it. He is saying, don't pay attention to any image that's going to be found of an Ark of the Covenant or of the cherubs in the future. That's what he says in the Bible. In 2 Maccabees, however, it says that it's going to be graced in the future, and it means that people will come back to it when fire from heaven is brought down, like in the time of Solomon. What it means is, if you look at it very carefully, is that no doubt they're going to either find the Ark of the Covenant again over there, and God will allow it to happen. They'll either find the cherubim that were taken out of the temple and disqualified, one of them was. And you know what they're going to do? The people at the end of the age, I'm talking just about a few years in advance of us, they're going to build another temple over there, and if the greatest archaeological find of all time could take place, like it says in 2 Maccabees, they would find the tent, they would find the Ark of the Covenant, they may even find the cherubs themselves, and they would find the incense altar, and you know, made by Moses himself. And they would want to do what with it? Put it back into the temple. And if one of the cherubs is missing, they would want to perhaps make an image of him, because it's allowed in the Bible, you see. It's allowed in the Bible. The only problem is, in the time of Ezekiel chapter 28, one of those cherubs was disqualified, and he has no right to be back in that temple. But you know, that image of the beast that's mentioned there in the book of Revelation, no doubt is an image of a cherub. And the people will be using things that were perfectly proper in Moses' day to misuse them in the few years in advance of us. Actually, John is telling us, little children, keep yourself from idols. Because some things are people don't think are idols, they are very much that way. That's why I'm declaring war on idolatry. What we need to do is to get God's definition of what idolatry is and stay away from it. This concludes the lecture on...